But the fact of a genetic syndrome or a brain abnormality had not really been factored into, hey, maybe this is why the child is having trouble speaking. Oh, well, he must be autistic. Uh-uh, not necessarily.
Hello and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. On the show, I interview peak performing innovators in the creative, social impact, and earth conservation spaces. I also bring you ideas and techniques that you can grab and use to set goals, create, and unlock your potential for changing yourself and the world. And now let's get to the show. There, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. Thank you so much for being here. I'm also incredibly grateful for this week's guest. You are going to love this wonderful, very, very, very fascinating person. Let me tell you about Dr. Shoshana? I can't believe I even said her name wrong. I'm so excited. Shoshana Levin-Fox. Let me tell you about her. She's a Jerusalem-based child psychologist, play therapist, and autism specialist. Play therapist and autism specialist, those two together is amazing. At the world-renowned Feuerstein Institute between 1992 and 2017, she found that conventional autism assessment methods overlooked underlying causes and disregarded the children's strengths. Amazing. Inspired by the work of Professor Feuerstein and the DIR floor time originators, Drs. Weider and Greenspan, she decided to apply creative interactive methods of assessing and treating children considered autistic. Talk about innovation. The dramatically positive results of this unconventional clinical approach impelled her to write the recently published An Autism Casebook for Parents and Practitioners, The Child Behind the Symptoms. Wow. Shoshana has received many academic awards, including, and I'm going to see if I can get all of these letters in, an SSHRC postdoctoral fellowship. She shared her wealth of experience in autism in numerous publications and conference presentations worldwide. Wow. Shoshana, so grateful for you being here. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Isolde. I'm really delighted to be here.
There's so much to what I just talked about in your bio that it blows me away that you have decided to make your life's work about something that most of us don't really know anything about, and that's autism. And before we even get started in this incredible topic, I would love it if you could tell me, what is autism? How is it defined?
Excuse me. Well, Isolde, you know what? It depends who you talk to. Helpful, right?
That's really good.
let me go into it a bit with you.
Please.
It so depends who you talk to. So if you talk to people who are using conventional means of assessment and diagnosis, they will now tell you autism is a spectrum. If you talk to Shoshana Levin-Fox, she will tell you that she abides by the very earliest formulation of what are the criteria for autism. And that was a long time ago. That was 80 years ago. And a psychiatrist, actually, by the name of Kanner, identified two very tight, very narrow criteria for autism. So let me give you a taste of it, okay? Mm-hmm. So we could just sort of say, you know, autism, I could say it's according to the DSM, which is the Manual of Diagnoses, is a very broad spectrum. But I prefer a diagnostic criteria that are much, much more specific. And what Kanner was saying 80 years ago was that there are two criteria. What were they? An extreme emotional cutoffness and an obsessive insistence on sameness. In other words, he was talking about some very extreme behavioral and personality, shall we say, phenomena. Well, today we've got a range, and that's really the impetus for my work, because I think that's creating a lot of problems. So in general, it's a severe, in my estimation, a very severe communication and developmental impairment. So you're talking to Shoshana, you're getting, that's the those are the criteria, Kanner's criteria. Now in some quarters, he's fallen out of favor. He hasn't fallen out of favor with me. And I found that very helpful in helping so many children. I must have seen in my 25 years at the Feuerstein Institute, literally thousands of children who had been diagnosed using the formal conventional criteria, who had been diagnosed as autistic. And I found that many of them, in fact, a large percentage, were not really autistic at all, according to those original criteria. Does that help give you a flavor of what's going on?
It really does. And it's fascinating because it seems like there's been probably thousands that have been misdiagnosed, right? If we're sticking to this original criteria, I love these two criteria, by the way, the notion of being emotionally cut off or withdrawn, mm-hmm. but also mm-hmm. really needing that sense of routine, that things be very much right. the same, one identical right. from the other. That makes a lot of sense to me, especially thinking about the people I know who have autistic children. And yet we have, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of kids being diagnosed as autistic
That's right.
By this definition, they would not be. So if they are not autistic,
that's correct.
What are they?
What are they? Right. That's a question, Isolde, that so many parents that came to my office at the Feuerstein Institute, so many parents would ask me, well, if he's not autistic, Dr. Shoshana, what is he? And first of all, I would say to them, not all developmental conditions have labels. That's very important to understand. Mm-hmm. It's very important for me to share that with parents. We can understand what is happening with a child without giving it the label of autism or another label. Some conditions that children have do have specific labels. Others don't, and it doesn't mean we can't help the child, and it doesn't mean we can't understand the child. I want to expand on this a little bit because for many people, that's what? If you can't give it a name, then how can you understand it? But you can. You can understand it by asking yourself lots of clinical questions. Where could this have come from? What could be creating this situation? So, the vast majority of children that I saw that were diagnosed using the conventional, very expansive, very elastic criteria that talk about a range of symptoms, the vast majority of them, in my estimation, had been misdiagnosed. And that's a big problem. That's a big problem. It's a big problem for the child, and it's a big problem for the parents. And my work, my cause, was to help the parents understand whether the child was classically, genuinely autistic or was falling into this nebulous spectrum category that wasn't really helping us understand the child. Is that making sense?
It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll notice that I do this. Shoshana, I will stop for a second and I will take mm-hmm. in what you've said and sort mm-hmm. of, I don't, some people call it dead air. I call it anticipatory air. So it might take, it might take me a minute, but
because
I want to take in what you've said, because it's fascinating right. to me because right. first of all, if a child is diagnosed as autistic, when that mm-hmm. child is not autistic, then treatments, and I don't know actually truly what all those treatments might be, that would be applicable to an autistic child might not work to one who isn't autistic. Is that an appropriate thing to say?
It's more than appropriate. It's 100% bang on, because when you have this, one detail I think that's important, for example, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the fifth version, the diagnostic criteria for autism, they speak of a range of symptoms. So that means, as I've said, that a lot of children are falling under this great big nebulous umbrella. What are the implications of this misdiagnosis and this misunderstanding of a genuine autism? First of all, and this I often found quite tragic, was the child's strengths are often overlooked. Okay? Mm-hmm. The child may have a great sense of humor, be very, have many, many strengths. I'm not thinking of the right now. I have to think of a real child in front of me, and then it'll be easier to speak. But for example, a child who comes in walking on his tiptoes, which is often was associated with autism in years past, less so these days. Adorable, sweet, aware of his surroundings, not great language, very, very shy. Eye contact kind of iffy at first, but once I get him to the table and we start to play, he's really a joy to work with. So there you go. Surface impression is of a child who's withdrawn. Get involved with the child and you find he's right there. Yes, he's still walking on his toes sometimes. Yes, he may be, this is not associated with autism. This particular child had a little bit of drooling problem. So that told me that there was something in his motor tone that needed help. So the strengths of this child in getting a kind of an autism diagnosis had been overlooked. He was a great with it kid and extremely intelligent. And I saw these kind of things for many, many reasons over and over again. So the strengths are overlooked. And often the underlying difficulties of a child who is experiencing a developmental problem, but not necessarily autism. And I object to the use of autism as a one-size-fits-all diagnosis. I think that actually I saw children being harmed by it, and I basically devoted the years I was at the Feuerstein Institute to strengthening the parents, helping them see the child through the eyes of another, the lens of another paradigm, through the lens of the potential of their child. I help them understand that the diagnosis itself, the criteria these days are so elastic. I would say to mom across the table from me, you know what, mom, you or I on a bad day, take a look at this. And I'd pull out my copy of the DSM-4 at the time, and then later the DSM-5 and say, what do you make of this? And they'd say, well, it's very general, isn't it? I said, yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I wanted them to understand that. And then from there, I would coach them to not only to identify and appreciate their child's strengths, but help them understand what to do with those strengths so that they could enhance them. And then the symptoms that looked autistiform, not autistic, autistiform, would gradually fade. Saw that in many cases.
I'm fascinated. Okay. So.
And excuse me, one more point connected mm-hmm. to what you said before. You're absolutely right that so often the treatment decisions and the educational placement decisions would then be made based on this too readily obtained spectrum diagnosis, and people were not necessarily, the system, so to speak, was not relating to what might be causing this child's social communication problem. I'm not denying that the vast majority of the children that I saw had developmental problems. They did, in spades, many of them, but each one was an individual, and I only used the term autism when I felt that the child fit into those original classic criteria. And that really informed my work. It helped me. It helped me guide the parents. And Isolde, we saw so many children change. And I say we because it was also my inspired mentor, the professor, and also I had wonderful, extraordinary, talented colleagues. It wasn't a one-man show or a one-woman show.
Huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. It because it's so fantastic to me to hear that you this is the Innovative Mindset podcast. So it's fascinating to me to see you innovating by going back 80 years, right? It is interesting. No, because I feel sometimes, honestly, Shoshana, like when we're talking about DSM-4, DSM-5, some of these issues and challenges that people have, whether they're developmental or specifically strictly environmental conscious. Or psychologically conscious in nature.
Yeah.
It seems to me, and I don't know if you want to address this, it seems to me like there's an umbrella that gets put over people who are different in some way as, let's diagnose you as X or as Y.
Right.
And then it makes things a lot harder for that person because suddenly they're lumped in with something that may have nothing to do with them.
Well, I would say yes and no. For example, there are, there's a whole strata of young adults, older adults, my hypothesis is because the criteria of the diagnosis have been stretched incredibly, that a lot of them are getting diagnosed as autistic and they're embracing it and they're finding it very helpful. And I would never take that away from someone, this has helped me find myself. Okay. But the autism that I'm talking about with young children who couldn't speak, who didn't know where they were, who couldn't orient themselves in space, who were far from being able to go into a regular first grade. That's a different kind of autism. And yes, the innovation I think that that I'm talking about is saying, let's also use our clinical skills and some common sense when we're looking at a child and not lump them all again, in this elastic one-size-fits-all diagnosis. We're doing a great disservice to the child and the parents, as you can imagine. And the parents themselves, when they get the diagnosis, some of the older adults who are getting this diagnosis seem pleased with it. I didn't work with older adults. And if I did, they were incredibly impaired in their autism. But the parents that I saw in my office, I would say when their child was diagnosed, not by me, they had all been diagnosed elsewhere at other clinics, famous clinics by famous experts using conventional means, very easy to get yourself an ASD diagnosis. The parents were crushed. Those are the parents I saw for 25 years, hundreds, I would say thousands of them, because every year I was maybe seeing 200 different children. At least 50% of them had arrived at my office being diagnosed as autistic. So I saw a lot of parents, and the impact on the parents was profound. It was ranged from discouraging to devastating. So I really had my work cut out for me in trying to help the parent see their child through a completely different lens. Because as you know, if you have criteria that you think have the stamp of the medical establishment, which I guess they do because they're the APA and so on, psychology, all right. It's hard to argue against that, isn't it?
You know, it's interesting. It's a little bit white lab coat syndrome, right? Somebody tells you you have X, so then you start thinking, that must be it. But it also feels to me like, especially autism, my husband has, he's not autistic. He has ADD and he's diagnosed as ADD. And I talk about it on the show all the time. And for him, what the diagnosis meant was, oh, well, that explains a lot. Right. So in this situation, the thing is with ADD, there are things that you can do that he can do that behaviorally without needing drugs or whatever to help himself. And I'm wondering with these autism diagnoses, is there a recognition? Is there, it's, you said the parents were crushed, and is it because there's a fear that there's no way to make it better? What causes the crushed part of it?
I think so for the parents of the young, sort of a sense somewhere along the line, it wasn't Shoshana, but somewhere along the line, someone or lots of people have decided that these children were born that way and they always will be that way.
Mm.
And I was working from a different paradigm, very strongly influenced by the late and truly great psychologist, Professor Reuven Feuerstein, who was a real iconoclast. You would have loved him. You would have loved him, Isolde. He would have been your star guest, you know. And basically, we put the most paradigms in psychology, they look for the diagnosis. We put the diagnosis aside. Most assessment processes look for symptoms. We wanted to look for the child behind the symptoms. Most assumptions regarding autism, apropos of your question, are a generally poor prognosis. No, that wasn't part of our vision. The child is modifiable because, according to the professor, the human being and the human brain is modifiable, which, by the way, has since been shown by brain plasticity studies.
Mm-hmm.
Many people consider autism to have been determined by biology, neurology, genetics. And in the professor's worldview, these are, we do not deny the influence of biology, neurology, or genetics, but these are, get this, influences, but not determinants, not determinants of the potential. So this is just a taste. We were just working so differently. And yes, parents were crushed because I think they were buying into the more medical vision of this, that, wow, experts at such and such a hospital told me my child is autistic and he was born that way. And then they'd say to me, but I remember him at his first birthday. He was so full of joy and life, and he was speaking his first words. And I would say to them, trust yourself. That little boy is still in there. Let's see if we can figure out what's happened to him that got him off track. What can we do to get him on board again? And we did. We worked hard. In many cases, we got him on board again. So I think a lot of parents buy into, are strongly persuaded, assuming that that's, you know, that's a case. It's biological, it's neurological. We just said, you know, the professor Feuerstein is wonderful. He had a great, great, he was quoted in Le Monde, of all places, in French, which I'll spare you because my French is not so great. But he said, I will never give the chromosome the last word. In other words, it has a say, but I won't give it the power to determine who this individual is. And in parallel, in working with autism, or for that matter, any other disorder or syndrome that came our way at the Institute, we would never give the diagnosis the last word, never. And it took a lot of work to get the parents on board. Some parents didn't join us in that vision. That's certainly their right. It always gave me great sadness when I could see, also my colleagues and I could see the potential, the wonderful potential in a child. We could see whether it was learning disabled or Down syndrome or autistic or gifted underachiever. We could see that potential. And yet the parent had been kind of discouraged, so discouraged. I think, well, now we've got a name for it. That explains what's wrong with my child. And here's these people at the Feuerstein Institute saying, no, that's not the case at all. I understand that. Actually, I do understand that, Isolde. I actually wrote about it in the book, in Autism Casebook. I said, to a certain extent, for a parent to adjust to the fact that their child has a certain diagnosis with all of the pain that they might go through to adjust to that, and then come to a place where not only I, but the professor and other wonderful colleagues, gifted, were saying, no, put that aside. Your child can learn to read. Your child can be integrated in a regular setting. You might be a year behind. You can do that. That's a very painful adjustment. It's a very pain to go back on what you've already may have, in some cases, mourned. So I understood that. Always rejoiced when we were able to get the parents on board and say, trust us a little bit. How about you stick with us for some follow-ups for about 2-3 months? Could you do that? And I'll coach you. And at the end of each month, we'll meet again. And you tell me what you're noticing. You tell me what you're seeing. Are we getting somewhere? And often we were. And once they started to see change, then we could work together quite well.
I love that. And I can see, I don't have children myself. I have cats. And I can see the fear of false hope. Right.
That's so right.
Thinking
that's
that it, right. that it would be nothing. And also right. here in the USA, there are benefits to parents, right? There
that's
are extra
right. that
resources
is correct. That is correct.
If your child has some sort of that's developmental right. issue. So and it's not that I'm saying parents are being, you know, Machiavellian about this at all. I'm
no,
saying that,
not
that
at all.
Once you have a diagnosis, you have
right.
resources that you might not otherwise have. So there is that part of it also. And
yes.
How do you, I don't know. I'm not sure what the question is here, because I feel like there's a courage that you're asking parents to dip into mm-hmm. to trust that this could work, that this might work, and some of these other resources might no longer even be necessary, but also not available. What are your thoughts on that?
Sure. You're absolutely right that the diagnosis, that, for example, the autism diagnosis can open up a whole world of resources, not all resources, but a whole world, particularly the ABA. I worked from a different model, as you know. I worked from the DIR floor time model. And I guess we could talk about that a little later. But let me give you an example. Again, remember that most of the children and that I saw had been diagnosed at other clinics from all around the world, primarily from Israel, but also people came from all around the world, as autistic. PDD in the old days, autistic disorder, and now ASD, more recent years, in other clinics. So the parents already had those resources in place. They'd already applied here in Israel, for example, to the national insurance, which, just like in the States, will then pays out an allowance to parents, a monthly allowance that enables them to get some of the extra therapies. So when I was seeing a child, and if they weren't autistic, although their documentation said that they were, I said, no, here's what I think has happened to your child, and here's what I think we could do. In the same sentence, I would say, but relax, mom and dad. I'm not going to pick up the phone to the national insurance and say, do you know that Joey's not really autistic? No, you need that money doesn't mean the child doesn't still need speech therapy. You need to get DIR floor time. You need, use that money for him. Absolutely. You deserve it. He deserves it. So here in Israel, I was able to sort of put parents at ease. That was, in a sense, they had already made that decision. They had already applied. Most parents, once they had gotten the diagnosis elsewhere, had already applied for that money, and they could put it to good use for the child. But I said, let's separate the two. Use the money to advance the development of your child. But I'm telling you, according to a genuine autism, your child is not autistic. Would it be useful for me to go into some of the situations that I saw that, not case examples just yet, but the kinds of things I saw that were commonly misdiagnosed? Would that be
sure?
If relevant?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm happy to do that. I just want to say a proviso to parents who might be listening, and I put this in the book as well, because parents are so caring and, of course, by nature, completely involved, and they hear a specialist saying, well, for children who were not really genuinely autistic, these were the following conditions. And they hear this kind of list that I'm going to give out. They go, oh, no. So maybe it's not autism. That if any parents are listening, and I hope they are, please do not go there. Okay. I'm just going to talk about what I commonly saw. It does not apply to children of parents. It requires to ascertain what's really going on with the child. I would spend something like 4 2-hour observation and play sessions with the child. So I just want to put the parents who may be listening, I want to put them at ease. So what I often encountered was general developmental delays. Sometimes the reason was clear, sometimes it wasn't. Emotional issues from mild to very serious. I'm going to use a fancy schmancy term here, oral dyspraxia, which basically means the muscles of the mouth are not hardwired to the brain. So the child understands language. They really want to communicate, but they can't. It's a little bit, if I ask you to wiggle your ears, you say, oh, I really like to do that. Oh, my God, that won't do it. I know what's involved. So in other words, the muscles of the mouth were not working. Genetic symptoms or brain abnormalities. Please, any parents listening, just please relax. Okay. These had already been diagnosed in other clinics. I'm not a child neurologist or a geneticist, but the fact of a genetic syndrome or a brain abnormality had not really been factored into, hey, maybe this is why the child is having trouble speaking. Oh, well, he must be autistic. Not necessarily. Range of hearing problems, those would break my heart. Those would break my heart. And I invested so much energy to help the parents understand that if you're, say, your child up to the age of 3 had a lot of fluids in his or her ears, well, of course, his hearing would be compromised. And then naturally speech would be compromised. And then naturally social relationships would be compromised. So that was, and I spend a lot of time saying to the parents, look, it says here your child has had fluids and you only recently got grommets in his ears. This is good news. I said, what's good news? I said, now we understand why your child is just so warm and present and wonderful. He's not autistic at all. But he does have an expressive language problem that needs some help. And then, and these also broke my heart, and I invested tons of energy to help parents of these children as well. Typical, normal children who just needed a little more time. They were just ripening according to schedule. They needed another year in kindergarten. No problem, mom and dad, let's do it. And there were many gratifying stories, Isolde. So those were some of the commonly encountered situations that, again, because of this elastic diagnosis, they would fall under the one-size-fits-all ASD. And those underlying aspects were not being addressed. So that as they should have been. I wouldn't say they weren't being addressed at all, but we tried to correct it.
Yeah, it seems to me in listening to what you're saying that if those underlying issues weren't being addressed, then the behavior would persist. The way the child is would persist right. because they weren't being addressed. And so
makes sense.
Yeah, I mean it really does make all sorts of sense, but I want to step back a little bit if it's okay with you.
Sure.
You said something that I thought was really interesting. You said bringing the child on board. And as you said that, I went on board what? And I'm the question. No, because we have a set of societal norms that dictate what that norm is, right? This we have by a certain age we're supposed to be able to speak, by a certain age we're supposed to be able to tie our shoes. These are all whatever those things are. But that seems to me to be the spectrum, right? My younger sister could not tie her shoes until she was a teenager because she grew up with Velcro shoes, for example. There was absolutely nothing wrong with her. She's a genius, but she never learned to tie her shoes. And I still don't know how to tie my shoes properly, actually, because I'm a lefty and somebody tried to teach me the right way and I couldn't do it. And I'm you know, but those kinds of things, like when we immigrated to this country, to the USA, mm-hmm. English was my fourth language, right? By the time I got here, I spoke a bunch of languages, but there was no ESL program. So they dumped me in first grade and went, well, sink or swim. And they thought, wow, she's not very smart, is she? And I spoke no English. So that, you know, those kinds of things, this isn't a pity me thing. It's a, and then they found out I actually knew all my multiplication tables. And, she is smart, right? Because I met some benchmarks. So I wonder with that, with these children, and predominantly children, I think, how do we make that part of it elastic? If you see my question, like the elasticity of the diagnosis is already here, right? In DSM-5,
and certainly
right, but it's certainly already here, right? We're already kind of lumping people who might not be autistic at all in with people on what they call the autism spectrum. But then there are some of these are based on what we consider to be the benchmarks you should have achieved by a certain developmental phase, if you will. And is there room for there to be elasticity in that? That, like you said, I mean, right. Oh, please answer, because otherwise I'll just keep chatting about it.
there sure should be. And that's really how we worked. Maybe I'll share with you a term that helped us very much. And it's out there in psychology, but for me, Professor Feuerstein breathed new life into it. And that's this whole idea. And this helped us strengthen the children and the parents. Getting the parents on board was really, really critical. We couldn't work without them because they're just, if they start to, we can coach them, then we can really get things moving. Mm-hmm. So the term is islets of normalcy. So picture in a whole sea of symptoms, little flashes of normalcy. Now, some people might object to the word normalcy. There is no longer anything that's normal. But for old-fashioned folks like me that were helping lots of kids with a more cautious vision of autism, an islet of normalcy could be just a flash of eye contact, a little bit of a teeny bit of purposeful use of object. Kid is sort of flapping a pencil and shaking it in front of his eyes, which is sort of typical of stereotypical behaviors of autism, and suddenly draws a circle. That's significant. That's an islet of normalcy, a little sign of curiosity, a smile and a flash of pleasure in contact, vocalization, in other words, making sounds, not even necessarily words, using it, that's great. Gestures, using pointing, super, a great developmental sign. Isolated words. So we would, now I'm going to change. So I found that an enormously helpful metaphor to be holding in my mind. And I shared it with the parents. At the end, you know, they're sitting there, first appointment, very depressed. I said, but did you see this? But did you notice that? But did you see that? But did you see that? I said, that's not to be disregarded, as it often is in conventional assessment of these children. I said, that's where we want to put our energy. That's telling us about your child behind the symptoms. And then now I'm going to switch metaphors. I don't know if you were ever in Girl Scouts when you got to the United States. Have you ever made a bonfire? Ever made a campfire? You start with a tiny spark. So I take these, my whole coaching of parents was to help them understand what they could do at home. That wasn't the whole story. The child still needed DIR. The child still needed speech therapy, perhaps, occupational therapy, perhaps. But it was really important for me and for our whole team to help these parents understand how to talk with their child and how to play with their child. And then you could take these little sparks, which are the islets of normalcy, and kind of breathe oxygen on them, and you could help them grow. Now, it might sound like airy-fairy, like, yeah, sure, but it happened again and again and again. So I hope that helps in a sense. So yes, I think there should be a much broader vision of children's potential. Absolutely. That children, you know, with this diagnosis, we don't need to give it the power. We shouldn't be giving it the power to determine who the child is.
I love that so much. Absolutely. Yay. Okay, first of all, and I will say, I don't mind airy-fairy. That's fine, because I firmly, I firmly believe that a lot of the things that we think are these miraculous things today, we might just not have the instruments to measure yet, and maybe in 100 years we will. So lots of unexplained phenomena now have explanations. Mm-hmm. So I'm good with that. I'm good with looking at it from that perspective. You've mentioned something, though, that I love, first of all, several times, and we haven't really touched on it, and that is play. Okay, I love the notion of connecting, because you're saying islets of normalcy, and I'm going islets of awareness, islets of connection, islets of curiosity. Those are the things that I'm thinking about when I'm listening to you. And what a beautiful way to connect to that is play. Can you talk a little bit about how play, what role play plays, if you will, in what you're doing and what you did with these kids?
Sure. Well, play, you know that I'm a play therapist, so play is close to my heart, but play in general is really a developmental powerhouse. In our society, we tend to somewhat disregard it. Oh, play is the opposite of working. But no, play, it's so powerful in the sense that it's a two-way street. On one hand, the play of a child is a mirror. It mirrors their developmental abilities in all areas. I'll just pick out a few: language, communication, motor development, how they think, how they put ideas together, their personality, their emotions, how they relate, their capacity for imagination. So if we understand how powerful play is, and we realize that it's a mirror of what's inside the child, that's step one. The other thing is that play can be a catalyst for changing those very areas that I've just mentioned. In other words, there are ways to use play. To do it justice would probably take, I'd say, about 2.5 hour workshop. But, excuse me, but to put it in a nutshell, one very, very fateful day, I had been at the Feuerstein Institute. It was 1992, maybe for 3 months. And I walked into the professor's office, and he's sitting there, and he said, I'd like you to meet Serena Weider. Well, I'm embarrassed to say, I didn't know who Serena Weider was. Nice to meet you. Then I began to hear and read about her phenomenal work, along with the late and sadly missed Dr. Stanley Greenspan, child psychiatrist. And they have developed what's called DIR floor time, which D for developmental, I for individually attuned to the sensory needs of the child, and that's the key here, and R for relationship. It's always taking in, working through emotions, working through the relationship with the child. We're not going for what Serena sometimes called splinter skills, how to write your name, how to say good morning. No, no, no. We're working with the whole personality of the child. So I'd be happy to give you a couple of examples of how play can make a difference.
Sure.
Sure. Okay. I think I'll start with, I've got a few ideas. Sometimes the difference is really, really tiny. And I'll start with a tiny one. It's actually a child that I was invited to a country in Europe to talk about what we were doing at the Institute in the field of autism, to give some workshops and to see some children. And talk about pressure. I was in a room where there were about six therapists behind the observational window, and there was this little guy sitting in the beanbag chair, quite content, no verbal communication. But I knew right away, I said, this is not autism. He's here. I could feel his presence. He was watching me, but he wasn't giving me direct eye contact. And I tried to just take out cars and things and puzzles, forget it. And I was in a panic because, I was an autism specialist invited to work with a child, people watching from the other side of the, the observational window. And then I said, just calm down, center, and think developmental thoughts. And the first developmental thought, taking a tip from DIR floor time, was sensory. So I spoke very softly. I'll call him Gordy. I got down on my knees in front of Gordy, who still wasn't looking at me. He was just satisfied to be sitting there. No perseverative behavior, no flapping or waving objects. I said, Gordy, I'm going to take off your shoes now. I hope that's okay. Now I'm going to take off your socks and I'm going to rub your feet. And I rub the right foot and then the left foot. Did that for a while, and Gordy started to look at me because working with the DIR mentality, I'd gotten a route in through the sensory channel, kind of baby play, even though he was about 4 years old. And then I thought, what have I got to lose? And his feet are bare. And I'm thinking, I sure hope his feet are clean. But I excuse me. I would lean to the right and his eyes followed me to the right and kiss the sole of his left foot and then lean to the left, my left, kiss the sole of the other foot, and Gordy's eyes are following me back and forth. He's interested in the kiss. He's interested in the baby type attention. And I knew that was a start. I knew that was a start. What his mother, I never followed up. I'm sorry to say on this case, I can't tell you what happened then. I can tell you what happened immediately after, and it was very moving because I had met with his mother before the session. She had submitted all kinds of developmental information, and she was really the picture of discouragement and sadness. And after this session, where I had a little weensy teensy little island of normalcy and a weensy teensy little breakthrough through baby playtime, she came into the room to pick up Gordy, and she just started talking to him like nobody's business. Okay, Gordy, you know what? I'm going to put your shoes and socks on now. It's time for us to go to the car, and we have to pick up Daddy. So something in her had changed. I can only hope, Isolde, that it went someplace. Do we have time for me to give you another example of something with play?
We have all the time in the world.
Okay. I'll call this little girl Evie, and she was about 5 years old. She had been diagnosed elsewhere as autistic, and I'd been following her not once weekly. We operated like a clinic. We didn't have the time, unfortunately, neither did the parents. So like once a month, follow up, give the parents homework, coach them, check in a month later. Let's keep moving, folks. So Evie came in for one of her sessions, and a little bit of a tough nut to crack, a little bit challenging. Challenging in the sense that you couldn't make a direct approach to her. Mm-hmm. I put her on my lap. I had a mirror in my room, a small mirror that I could detach and put on the floor when I needed to sit on the floor with the child. So I sat on a chair, and I put Evie on my lap. And of course, in the mirror, this was kind of baby playtime, and she was 4 or 5. You get better eye contact, and it's less threatening. So I'm looking at her in the mirror. She's looking at me through the mirror. Eye contact is very, very nice. And I start sort of wiggling my head and making funny faces. And she starts to giggle and to imitate me to a certain extent. So there are some important islets of normalcy that I'm trying to breathe life, energy, warmth, caring, belief, you name it, into, and she's responding. At a certain point, she got down on the carpet, and I started to tickle her gently. Parents in the room, by the way, I do not touch, like, if I'm touching a child, I ask the parents' permission. I'd like to take a, in Gordy's case, I couldn't because mother was on the other side of the mirror, but I felt that was okay. Everybody was watching. So I said to the parents, you know, I'd like to do this. I'd like to tickle. I'd like to do this. Is that okay with you? And just be very, very careful and cautious with the use of touch these days. Unfortunately, we're living in a pretty sick world. That even kind of what might have been normal touch of a child 30 years ago no longer goes. Anyway, she got down on the floor, and I continued sort of tickling her tummy. And every time I would tickle her, she would look away. So then I'd crouch down and get on the other side of her and tickle. We had a little game of, I don't know if you can picture it, but sort of she's looking away and then I'm coming to see her and then she's looking away and I'm coming to check out her eyes. Meanwhile, tickling her very gently all the time. The use of play with these children is critical. I would say to parents who came to me after, let's say they'd been to famous hospital, okay, and they'd had a team of 6 high-powered individuals assessing the child using conventional means. And I would ask the parent, I'd say, did anybody play with your child? Sometimes yes, most of the time no. And I came to the conclusion that if you're seeing a child that you suspect autism and you haven't gotten down on the floor and tried to use a sensory channel along DIR floor time lines, if you haven't done that, you haven't tried to engage the child, to just list symptoms is to do the child a great service, because it's a disservice, because it's through the play that we have a chance of reaching the child and helping the child grow. DIR floor time, I think, is just fabulous. I sit at the feet of Serena Weider and when he was alive, Drs. Stanley Greenspan. I think they made an extraordinary contribution to the possibilities and to the development of young children with complex disorders of socialization and communication. Play is powerful. And I would encourage parents who haven't been exposed to DIR floor time to get on the website of ICDL, It used to be interdisciplinary. It's now the International Council for on Development and Learning, ICDL, and search for a therapist, and you get lists of thousands of therapists all around the world, and go for the ones that have the advanced training, the expert training, the advanced training, which incidentally, in the interest of absolute honesty, I don't. I have the basic, so here I am telling parents, but I've had tons and tons of experience, and in addition to getting the basic certification, had the great privilege, I would say, to attend many of Serena Weider's and Stanley Greenspan's conferences, workshops, smaller tutorials, all kinds of things. But in the interest of the future of children involved indirectly in this podcast, you know, as the audience of this podcast, I would say seeking out people with advanced, acknowledged training. But you get on the ICDL website and get wonderful, wonderful practitioners.
Thank you for those examples. I think they're fascinating, and it's.
I loved the work. I loved it. It was.
I can tell.
It was so exciting. It was so exciting, but it wasn't enough just for me to be excited. I had to help the parents share in the understanding of the significance of what was happening when I was working with the child. If that didn't happen, then I had failed. Even if I'd had a wonderful session with the child, I had to help the parent understand, see, this is your little child behind the symptoms. Isn't he so great? Here's what you can do to further the cause. And I'd teach them how to play with their child. I'd just take the barest essentials from DIR floor time. It's a clinic situation. I can't do a complete tutorial with all the parents. Give them the barest essentials, help them to understand how they could possibly play with their child, at what level, and the importance of doing that, how they should be talking to their child. There's ways of talking to your child that can enhance language. The language of the child. So yeah, it was wonderful work. I'm still doing some consulting. I left the Institute in 2017, as you mentioned. Still doing consulting, and I just thought of a wonderful play example. Would you like? Do we have time for another one?
All the time in the world, really.
You're amazing. This is a little guy that I saw here at home. I work out of my home now, about 2 months ago. I'll call him Charlie. Good example for sort of more advanced play, not the baby play. And Charlie, at the age of 3.5, has not been speaking. And of course, a number of specialists have seen him and have, using conventional assessment, they have, you know, given him the autism spectrum diagnosis. And so I had him here in my playroom. And I must admit, at first, Charlie almost convinced me, almost, that he was perhaps indeed autistic. What was missing, though, and that's why I held out with him, was there was no hand flapping, no perseverative behavior, no what's called stereotypical behavior. And here's how Charlie played. I was in the room, everything that I did to try to get Charlie to look at me, eye contact, repeat sounds that he's repeat. No words. He didn't have any words, but I'd repeat his sounds. Nothing. He iced me. Charlie just iced me. And then I sort of, again, calm down, watch this child. How's he playing? Well, he's putting the Playmobil people in the Playmobil vehicles. Okay, interesting. 100% appropriate. He's going over to the little kitchen corner and looks like he's cooking. Appropriate. This kid is with it. He understands what's going on in the world. And then he got kind of age-appropriate play, just without the soundtrack, okay, just, you know, someone turned the sound out and he was icing me. He wasn't going to look at me for love or money. And then he saw the fake pistol that I have, because I primarily do play therapy practice now. So I've got some plastic pistols in the room for kids who want to be robbers and cowboys and policemen and stuff like that. And he picked up the pistol and he was aiming it at me. And my mind flashed opportunity. And I put my hands up like, you know, please don't shoot. You know, please don't shoot. And he did. And I was sitting on the floor, sitting on the carpet. I lay down on the carpet. He burst into laughter. He burst into laughter. And it was like the plunk came out. He did not talk, but the sounds came flowing out of him. And at the end of the session, he was running around my living room like a little monkey, climbing on the table, hugging his father. That's not unusual for him, but he was full of life and energy. And I said to his parents, and making tons of sounds, I said to his parents, this is not autism. He's stuck. He has an expressive language problem. We can troubleshoot this. I think they went the route of special education and they went. It's always very sad for me. But it was just such a classic example of how you can get down on the floor, find that opportunity. It took, you know, and make a connection with the kid. And then, boom, he was right there. It was so exciting.
That's amazing. It's to me, when I think about autism, I think that the person who has autism or is autistic, that their interior world is more important than the exterior world to them. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me that when you're playing, there's an invitation there to the child to
absolutely
to come and be in the exterior world, and in the case of
that's the whole thing.
Yeah,
you got it. You got it. Excuse me, Isolde, and that's the difference between the play therapy model that I use in other contexts, where you create like the emotional greenhouse, the warm, accepting place where the child can unfold, and they do. And for me, it was kind of a short hop in DIR floor time. Serena uses a term often, woo the child. You're reaching out to the child. That was a big difference. And yet I was in the world of play, so it was comfortable. So you're absolutely right. You're creating invitations and you're looking for those openings for what DIR calls to create circles of communication, right? Which are perhaps sometimes initiated by the child. And then you as the adult, parent, practitioner, pick up on, keep that chaining going. Sometimes initiated by the practitioner, and the child picks up. For example, in my work at the Institute, a highly undervalued tool for assessing young children, I want you to know, is bubbles. Bubbles, I think, is one of the greatest assessment tools developed by mankind. Why? Mm. And I don't say that facetiously. I'd see a tense, somewhat withdrawn child look before me, I'd pull out the bubbles and they'd turn their head. They knew it was coming. Okay, interest. Start to blow the bubbles, and through the screen of bubbles, sometimes we had better eye contact because it was a little bit safer through the screen of bubbles, like through a beaded curtain, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I would take a finger maybe and go, pop, as I popped the bubble. And then maybe the child would start to move around and be purposeful. So in other words, it was both, I could use bubbles, wasn't the only thing, use tons of different kinds of play activities. But bubbles, for example, could be used as an assessment tool to see where the child was stuck and where there were openings. and at the same time, the beginning of kind of treatment, kind of opening the child up.
Yeah, for sure. Bubbles I love. And in fact, my husband, husband is, he was a hospital clown for a long time, and they'd go into all the different.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And it's lovely. And for nonverbal children, for very young children, for babies, they would blow bubbles. And
that's great.
It was always, it never failed. Bubbles never fail.
And you know why? You know why? My hypothesis about that. And I've used bubbles often to pull frightened children out of that anxious place, because adults are, well, first of all, hospitals in your husband's situation, a hospital is a scary place, period, for a child and for an adult.
Sure.
But, you know, people walking into my office, I'm not wearing a white coat, you know, I've got toys around and stuff like that. Okay. We still got an adult. We got a grown up and we got, a stranger. Okay. So that's pretty scary. But if a grown up stranger pulls out bubbles, they can't be all bad, can they?
For sure. And bubbles are colorful and they float and they're fun. I mean, there's something to me that's so, it's primary to us. You know, we love, like what you said earlier about airy fairy. I think we love wonder. And I think most of us have some relationship with what we wonder about, what we're curious about. And bubbles are kind of an object of curiosity. They float and then they pop and they go away, but you can always make more. So there's a lot there.
That's right.
You know,
it's
interesting how, as I'm listening to you, Shoshana, I think of it a little bit differently, or maybe it's the same, because there are so many kids, and I've done a lot of work in schools. When I was working at NASA, I spent a lot of time teaching at schools. And I remember this one time I was teaching, doing a workshop, a neuroscience workshop for a bunch of sixth graders in a math class. And I always start out with a map of the, not a map, a satellite image of the Earth. And it's a satellite image of the Earth that shows sort of the Arabian Peninsula and Northern Africa. And there was this one kid who, this is a kid of 35, a class of 35 students, and there's one kid, and he is just, he's a smart mouth, he's making jokes, he's running around the class, literally running around the classroom while I'm trying to teach. And I always ask questions like, what do you see? And some people saw, you know, oh, I see clouds, oh, I see water, oh, I see land. And I said to the kid who was running around, what do you see? We'll call him Jimmy. Jimmy, what do you see? And he looked over and he goes, I see the Arabian Peninsula. And then he kept running. And I went, and this was a satellite image, right? There were no geopolitical boundaries. And I said, you see the Arabian Peninsula, where is that? And he goes, it's right there. And he points it out to me. And I said, oh, what countries are on the Arabian Peninsula? And he goes, well, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Yemen, blah, blah, blah. And he goes through and he lists all the countries. And I said, oh, you know a lot about geography. And he goes, I love geography. And he keeps running. And what was interesting is that the rest of the class, whenever I could relate something back to geography, I'd ask him and he'd come out with the answer. And by the end of class, he was hanging out. He was interested. He was engaged.
I love it.
He was part of the class. And so when you're talking about kids who have developmental issues that maybe they're not communicative or maybe they're not easily reachable, but some of these same kinds of ways of doing things, I can't think of the word right now, they seem to apply regardless.
Yes. In other words, you start with where the child is.
Yeah.
But you see, you could have easily say, oh, that child has ADHD, and not necessarily written him off, but you went the other route, you know, and it's a very good parallel.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me because it is all about meeting the person. And this works with communication for everybody, meeting them where they are. You know, meeting them, speaking with them where they need to be spoken with. That to me seems like I always talk about this with my clients that, you know, that if you're going to communicate effectively, you need to communicate in the way they need to hear it, whatever that is. And so that was why I went the way I went with Jimmy, was because it is this, it's an opportunity. It's a lucky chance to reach someone, and everybody else had fun too, right? He wasn't as disruptive, but also we all had fun because we were able to, it was the Stump Jimmy hour. We were, anytime I could ask him a geography question or the other students could ask him, you know, we had a lot of fun with him at just answering all the questions because geography was the love of his life. And so,
he knew it.
Yeah, and he knew, I mean, at 11, which I found amazing. So I'm going to ask you this question, and I, because that was successful to me. That was an amazingly successful interaction. And the teacher said, Constantea Seas, who's an amazing, amazing teacher in Maryland, she said that the rest of the term, anytime she could relate things to geography, she did. And Jimmy had become her star pupil, you know. So that was lovely and delightful. But I'm wondering if you could tell me, Shoshana, what does success look like in your work?
Nice. I like the question. I think there are levels of success, Isolde. I think, so for example, when I was talking about Gordy and talking kissing his feet and feeling a shift in him from inside him and seeing the change in the parent, even though that was just the beginning of the beginning of the beginning of what I hope became a good path for him, that to me felt like a successful start, shall we say. Success in a more, I guess I'm thinking of cases. Would you like me to, just in general, I would say success has a range. It really has a range. Mm-hmm. Not all of the children that we worked with went on to become 100% integrated and so on. There were a lot of factors that determined that, not necessarily always the child's potential. There were a lot of things. The Israeli school system that was geared to special education as opposed to integration. We had a lot of challenges. So sometimes it was just like those little tiny baby steps. And many times, I'm happy to say that a lot of times we were instrumental in jump-starting profiles of children where the children were integrated, their speech and their relational capacities had improved tremendously. So, and the parents had also gained in confidence, shed their heavy load that they appeared to be. It really depended. I have to be honest, say it really depended, but there were a significantly large body of situations, not just in autism that we worked with at the Institute, but yes, in autism and in other, with other developmental challenges and learning challenges. I mean, we really saw often, it'll sound exaggerated, we saw miraculous changes sometimes that surprised the staff. And you know why? I think two reasons. I think one is we were working from a model that stressed the potential of the human being, not accepting things as they are, for starters, acknowledging them, but not accepting them. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. Understanding that human beings and the human brain by nature is modifiable, which has since been shown through all this brain plasticity. Feuerstein intuited that, early on in his career, and when brain plasticity became an item, he just sort of chuckled, I told you so. Mm-hmm. So one reason was working from that model, and it makes a difference. The model that you're working from, the vision that you have of what the child is capable of. And the other thing is that we worked hard. We worked hard. It wasn't like, oh yeah, your child has tons of potential. I think you'll be fine. No. We got down and dirty. We got down on the floor. We worked with the kids at the tables. We worked in multidisciplinary team. We worked hard. And I think that's why we were privileged to see, in some cases, not all, really wonderful, even miraculous kinds of changes. So I hope that answers It does. It's just a regret. Yeah.
It does, for sure. Well, we could continue this conversation for another 6 hours, but I know you have an evening to get back to. So I was wondering if before we close with my one last question if you're listening to this, if you've made it this far, we're going to do the bonus episode with Shoshana, but also I would love it if somebody wants to find you and also find the book. Would you mind giving the links like to your social media, your website, so that if somebody says I believe people have learned differently, so I'm absolutely going to include all of this in the show notes, but great. Some people learn listening, so I'd love it if you'd say where people can find you.
Sure, I will do that. I'd like to preface it with just the title of the book that I wrote, which I really consider my legacy to the field. I just had to share what worked because we were seeing a lot of changes, and I had to share stories of hope and encouragement and exciting change in real children. So I called it a case book, about 14 stories. Some of them are woven through with theory. Very accessible language. I want you to know that. It's not kind of highfalutin academic. It's real. And I've gotten feedback from people, so I guess we succeeded in that. So it's called An Autism Casebook for Parents and Practitioners, The Child Behind the Symptoms. But I'm sure if you just put in Amazon or Book Depository or the Routledge site, which was the publisher, put in an Amazon casebook. You don't have to remember the whole thing. How can people reach me? I have a website, ShoshanaLevinFox.com, just as it sounds. No extra N, ShoshanaLevinFox. And similarly, my name on Facebook, LinkedIn. That simple. And I love to hear from, that's one thing I've really enjoyed on the book journey, the book part of this journey, is meeting just the feedback and meeting people like all around the world. So yeah, so that's how to reach me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. I'm going to leave this next question for the bonus. There's a really amazing question that I'm going to ask her in the bonus episode, so you're going to want to come back and listen to that. But I have one last question, Shoshana.
Sure.
Before we say goodbye for this part, first of all, I want to thank you for joining me. What a phenomenal conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Isolde, for drawing it out of me effortlessly. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. What a lovely compliment. So I ask this question of everybody. It's the last question I ask. Everyone who comes on the show gets this question. And it's a silly question, but I find that it can yield some profound answers. And the question is this. If you had an airplane that could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
Oh, I love it. Okay. I know what it would be. It's not about what the child has. It's about what the child can become.
I love it. That's great. Thank you. I appreciate
that
so much. This has been such a great conversation. I'm super excited. I'm going to share it with the friends I have who have kids who have been diagnosed with autism, for sure, that they need to listen to this. This is wonderful. And you're multilingual, so that works great, because I imagine there'll be people contacting you from Ohio, from Pennsylvania, from Maryland, all sorts of places.
I speak Ohio very well.
The Midwest is a language all its own, for sure. I grew up in Michigan. I totally know. Again, Shoshana, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Isolde, so much.
This is Isolde Trachtenberg from the Innovative Mindset Podcast. You know that already. If you've enjoyed the episode, do me a favor, drop a review. I would love to hear from you what your thoughts are on the episode, on the podcast, where you think it's going, where you think it should be going. Until next time, I, as always, remind you to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Please subscribe to the podcast if you're new, and it would mean the world to me if you told a friend about it. Today's episode was produced by Isolde Trachtenberg and is copyright 2022. As always, please remember this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results, although we can always hope. Until next time, remember to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind.